We got Monique Giroux coming up on the podcast. You know, she's just released a book, Lost Intentionally. It came out days ago, The Inner and Outer Journey of a Spiritual Nomad. Monique spent 19 years with a big bank in Canada and then decided she was going to change her life and do something completely different. Buckle up. This is the story of a corporate banker, head of sponsorship at one of the big five banks here in Canada, and a total twist in her path. And she's living the life that she was called to live at this point. Enjoy the episode. Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line. Monique spent 19 years at a big bank here in Canada, CIBC, 15 years in sponsorship, and ended her career there as a VP of Corporate Events and Conference Center Management. Monique, you're in the SMCC Hall of Fame. You also now have had a complete transition, which is so interesting and I want to speak about because there's so many lessons in it. But you've got a little thing here called Lost Intentionality that you're going to be releasing on June 11th. I encourage everyone to go buy that. You are a forest therapist, if I have it correct, forest therapy guide, and you have Flourish with Monique, and you've done so many interesting things. I think you even have a collective of forest guides that you've worked with.
Yeah, the Forest Guide Circle.
And I guess, you know, let's finish my introduction and let's let you finish it because you were just in Thailand.
Yes.
And you did yoga training?
I did, yeah.
Tell us about that. Let's jump in.
Okay, let's do it. So we'll start with Thailand, which is the most recent experience. I guess we can work our way backwards. I was the oldest person in the yoga class. But I always wanted to, I wouldn't say I've always wanted to be a yoga teacher, but I've always practiced yoga probably for at least 35 years. So I took the class not necessarily to become a yoga teacher, but to learn as much as I could about yoga. And it also came with a sound healing certificate. So a big part of it was with sound therapy, and it was beautiful. It was on this tiny remote island in Thailand off the coast of Phuket, known as Koh Yanao. And it's a Muslim island. It's very quiet. It's not a party place. And I'll admit the first week, I would need a nap in the afternoon because it was a pretty grueling schedule, but I absolutely loved the experience.
Yeah, and I think we'll, you know, in some of these, I start off at the beginning and we work our way up, but mm-hmm. It's so, what you've done lately is just incredible and the world's got to know about it. And I hope they know about it through this book and through all the podcasts you've been on. But you talk about being the oldest person in that program. People would be scared shitless to do that. Like, what drove you to be like, I'm going to do this mm-hmm. at this point in my life and my career?
Well, this is where we have to go back a little bit further into the story, because in August, I started to travel solo. When I started that travel, I was not sure where I wanted to go. I had 8 months ahead of me to fill, and it was a little bit overwhelming at first. But I started in Portugal. I met with a group of women. We were all digital nomads over 50. It was a bit of a pathways program, and that kind of kick-started my solo travels. And I ended up kind of planning 1 month at a time and not getting too far ahead of myself, and ended up living at a monastery for 2 weeks in France, did some family ancestry research, and while I was in France, ended up finding a house of an ancestor who was born in 1635 in this house in this tiny, tiny village in France, and found out a lot of history about my family, which was fascinating. From there, I went to the Netherlands and did a 10-day silent retreat. And all of these activities, I feel like I was guided in a way. You know, when I left CIBC, I felt like I had been driving a steering wheel and controlling where the car was going. When I left the bank, I was letting go of the steering wheel and a little bit letting fate make some decisions and guide me. But then when I started traveling on my own, that shifted a little bit and it became more like I'm following breadcrumbs. And I don't know where those breadcrumbs are leading me, but I'm trusting. And I would just one breadcrumb at a time. And so I actually, with the yoga teacher training, I really wanted to go to India. I was nervous about going alone. And so I was doing some research online, and somehow this yoga training came up on my feed. I read about the teacher. She had a Buddhist background. And the location looked beautiful. At the time, I was in Vietnam, so it wasn't too far away. And so that's how that came about. It was a little bit of a spontaneous decision, but it was the right decision.
Yeah, and you mentioned, and I've heard you speak about it, these silent retreats. So how many of those have you done?
That was the second one. The first one I did shortly after I left the bank. So I left October 2021. The first Vipassana was January 2022, still in the pandemic. So they had moved it to virtual. And I stayed at a friend's cabin in just outside of Peterborough in the middle of winter. And every day at 3 o'clock, I would talk to the monk. He would interview me and ask me about my meditation, and he would give me guidance on what to focus on next. But that Vipassana, on day five, I was 2 hours in a deep meditation, and this entire book was downloaded into my mind. It just appeared. And that's what kickstarted this book.
That is amazing, and I want to dig into that. But the first thing that came to my mind when I heard this and was thinking, like, could I ever do meditation or silent retreat like this? What is your voice just comes back, right? You don't lose your speak after. You're just, after the 10 days, you're just talking again.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's been interesting to hear people's reactions to 10 days of silence.
Yeah.
You know, I've had people say, I don't want to know what's going on in my mind. I don't want to know myself that well. When I first started, and the first day, I had trouble sitting for 5 minutes and not, you know, I'd look at my watch and feel like a half hour had gone by and it was only 5 minutes. But I've come to learn that no one can stop their thoughts. You know, people think meditation is, I have to stop thinking, but it's like asking your heart to stop beating. You know, your mind is your mind. It's always going to be active. So it's really about slowing down and having a single point of focus and just focusing on how often are we multitasking and doing many things at once versus just one thing. We are in conversation right now. You know, let's focus on this conversation and just be completely in this conversation. Or I'm drinking my tea right now. I'm just going to focus on drinking my tea. That's meditation, or it's mindfulness, you know? And that's what I learned. I learned more about myself in those 10 days than I had in my entire life. It really was transformational.
So as you mentioned that, as I'm looking on my phone, I was looking up the word you said,
Vipassana.
Vipassana. And I read it in... you know, either one of the podcast show notes you had or on your LinkedIn. What does that mean? Does that just mean silent meditation? And what's the background of that word?
Yeah, it's a, it comes from a Buddhist tradition. And I'm not a Buddhist, so yeah. I don't know all the backstory on that. But it's a silent retreat. And there are lots of different schools of Buddhism that offer them. The one that I did, my teacher was Bhante Fimala Ramsey, who was a Buddhist teacher. He's recently passed away. So I can't tell you more than that. But there you can do a search for Vipassanas, and they offer them all over the world. There's a place just outside of Barrie, actually, that offers them on a regular basis, a Vipassana center.
Did you have to do anything to prepare yourself for going into silence for that long, or how did you prepare yourself mentally?
What I did it was more of preparing my life for it, right? Because I have a daughter, you know, if she needs to reach me, if there's an emergency, I need to be reachable. So I established a communication system with the person whose cabin I was staying in. I prepared vegetarian meals so that I would have food for the 10 days. Because normally these retreats are offered at a center and the meals are prepared for you. So the second Vipassana I did was with a group. It was in the Netherlands. It was just last year. And what was really funny about that one was, I mean, there's something about collective energy when you're meditating as a group that is very powerful. What was funny about that one was at the end of the 10 days, I had spent 10 whole days with this group of 25 people. And at the end of the 10 days, they announced that silence, it's called noble silence. Noble silence is over. And everyone just sat there. We were in the dining room and looked at each other. No one knew what to say. And so there was a solid minute of more silence because no one knew what to say. And then we all started laughing. And then we started talking to these, you know, this person across from me who I sat and ate with, you know, three times a day, but never spoke a word to. We got a chance to get to know each other at the very end. I thought it was really funny that once we could talk, no one knew what to say.
Was there a unique connection that you felt to these people? The fact you hadn't spoken with them, but you're spending this time together in silence, and now you have the opportunity to speak.
There was an older gentleman that kind of took it upon himself to volunteer to organize the snacks. In the afternoon, we would always have a piece of chocolate and a cup of tea. And so I started helping him prepare for those snacks. And sometimes, you know, I didn't know where they were stored. So there, you know, it was a little bit of eye contact and smiling. And he was, I just adored him because he just had such a beautiful soul. There were never any words, but it was just through eye contact and his smile. And he was probably about, I'd say, 80 years old. So I did tell him that once we were able to smile or to talk at the end, I told him how much I appreciated his smile and you could feel the kindness that he had as a person just from, you know, just from being in his presence. Quite beautiful.
Yeah, that's totally beautiful. And okay, let's go to the part of the book, the five days into this silent retreat, if I remember that correctly. The book's downloaded into your head. What does that look like?
It's hard to describe. Yeah. It just is there.
Yeah.
It's just this knowing. I knew what the 12 chapters were going to be. And I knew what the title of the book was going to be. And essentially it was about the teachings of that I had learned over the past few years since I started this journey of mindfulness and, you know, managing my anxiety. It was just there in an instant. I remember at 3 o'clock that day, I talked to Bhante, my teacher. I had my Zoom call with him. I was very excited about this book. You know, I always knew I'd write a book. I was an English professor when I first started my career.
I saw that. Cambrian College, right?
Cambrian College.
Where is Cambrian College?
Sudbury, Ontario, my hometown.
Yeah. Shout out to Sudbury.
The Sudbury Wolves.
That's right. There you go.
And I was an English major. So I always thought someday I would write a book, but I never knew what. And so when this just appeared, I finally knew, oh, this is what I'm going to write about. I was so excited. And when I told Bhante, he said, congratulations. You can focus on your book on Sunday when the Vipassana is over. And so I had to park it. That was the hardest thing because I just wanted to start writing it. But so that was a true test of my mindfulness to be able to continue with the meditation after just knowing that this was there.
What's the lesson there that you think you can take from that or pass on to other people? Because there's so many times where we're like, okay, we have an idea. We got to get to it now. And we're going to prioritize that over a family event, over taking our kids someplace, even though I don't have kids yet. What's the lesson there? You had this book downloaded and you have to say to yourself, no, I committed to this, this, and I'm here. And he was just straight up with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and patience has never been my strong suit. So it was a test of my patience. But you could take this idea and apply it to anything in your life. You know, like even if someone, you know, if you ask me a question, I don't need to immediately answer it. I could pause. I can pause, I can reflect, and then I can answer. And I feel like in our society today, everything is so rushed, even how we have conversations. So it was, to me, it was the lesson wasn't, it's okay to pause, take a break. It'll be there later. This is the focus. So, you know, with Bhante and one of my other Buddhist teachers is Thich Nhat Hanh. They teach the same principles around being focused on one thing and being in the present moment. I mean, I think that's the big key, is being in this present moment right now and not worrying about the future, or not, you know, if our mind is in the past reliving things that have happened, that's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. If our minds are in the future worrying or thinking about things that haven't happened yet, that doesn't exist and likely not going to happen the way you're envisioning it. It's going to happen. All that's real is this moment right now that we have right here.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think if we can, when we can stay in the present, and I shared before this started, and people that listen to the podcast, the global listenership out there really understands, you know, that, you know, I have gone through anxiety and depression and in my life, and, you know, I've worked my way out of it many times and gotten to a great place, and with work and therapy and medication, all that stuff, fitness was in mindfulness, meditation, as well as journaling. But you speak about the present, and a lot of times when you're in an anxious state, it's because you're worrying about either something you feel shameful about in the past, or you didn't do, or something in the future. And I mean, that's incredible advice, you know. And it is, and joking aside, but I threw the phone on flight mode, because it's like, no, we are here. It's just, this is it. Like, have a conversation, drink your tea, focus on what it tastes like, right? And we are running from one thing to the next. And I have a love-hate relationship with the city of Toronto, because I love being downtown, but I feel like, especially with the traffic and other things and work commitments, you are rushing a lot of the time, and it doesn't feel nice. And you know, I listened to one of the past interviews or podcasts you did, Manik, and I remember hearing you speak about not being able to breathe freely, and how when you went to Bali, I think in 2019, you experienced that. How long do you think you were experiencing some of that?
Yeah, so that was at the end of a 10-day retreat with my daughter. I took a deep breath and I realized for the first time that I didn't have pain in my chest from breathing. So that's I had this realization I was carrying anxiety. I believe it was for my entire career. But when I think back to my childhood, I was very shy. You know that term, painfully shy. People are surprised to hear that now. But as a child, I was painfully shy all the way through elementary school, high school, even university. And there was this defining moment where I got over my shyness again in an instant. It's just something happened that changed that. But I think my anxiety comes from this like angst, you know, this fear of being judged or saying the wrong thing, and always second guessing. And so with a career at the bank where there was always a lot of pressure, there was that angst feeling always in me.
I guess in a role like that, and you climbed to VP, were you the type of person that was working a lot of hours all the time? You were very focused on your career kind of thing. Like, was your goal or ambition to continue to climb once you were at the bank?
I was never an ambitious person. You know, I was never, like everyone's motivated by different things. And some people are motivated by the money. Some people are motivated by the title. I was motivated by getting recognized for good work. So I worked really hard, and all I wanted was someone to say, wow, you're doing a good job. That's it. You know, that pat on the back. And but literally at the expense of a lot of things. You know, I was married. I had a daughter. And I talk about this in the book, this one scene. I remember my daughter tugging at my pant leg when she was a toddler, asking for something. are needing my attention. And I was on my BlackBerry. That's how old I am. I had a BlackBerry back then. And I remember, you know, saying, oh, just 1 second. I just have to answer this email. You know, there was always this urgency to respond right away to things. And I think back now, that's my only regret, is not raising my daughter mindfully. And I've taught, she's 19 now, so we've had this conversation, and she always, whenever I bring it up, she says, Mom, I'm fine. You know, it turned out okay. I don't remember that, you know. But it's a good reminder for young parents that, I mean, I hear it all the time. You know, our children grow so fast, and then they're gone. And so it's, you know, what are the priorities in life? And I feel like I prioritize my job over other things in a way that I wouldn't today.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting there is, and shout out to BlackBerry Research in Motion. You know, I had a friend who worked there at a Brock University, and she was crossing the border to the States. And they're like, where are you going? She's like, work trip. They're like, where do you work? She's like, BlackBerry. They're like, what are you doing in Canada? She's like, that's where it's located. They're like, oh, I didn't know that. So anyways, shout out to a great Canadian company. That's a very interesting business case and story, and they put a movie out.
I enjoyed the movie. I watched it on a long flight.
Did you?
Over the last year. I thought it was interesting.
I gotta watch that. And yeah, the BlackBerries were great. How do you respond to somebody who might say, you know, while you were able to make it to a VP position and probably make good money at the bank, great money compared to a lot of people. And people might say, well, maybe that was some of the sacrifice you had to make or what you had to do. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that's true. Yeah, I think that you can. And I know a lot of executives who are successful in their work, but also have more balanced lives. And so I think it is doable. And when it's not, then you have choices you need to make.
So how would, if anyone's listening and they're in a career like you were before what you're doing now, how would you rethink prioritizing and setting boundaries, mm-hmm. especially with your experience now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have a better habits around self-care and around fitness and around eating healthy food, around mindfulness, around family time. And, you know, I really believe that, I used to say this all the time at the bank, we teach people how to treat us. And so what I was teaching my managers and, you know, the people that I reported into is like, give me more work, I'll do it. Like, I never said no, right? But I could have said no, I just didn't.
Yeah, and you know, staying with the conversation, but I had to write that down because that hits home, and I'm sure for so many it does. We teach people how to treat us.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, as a manager, we have a responsibility to be a role model for our team. So, you know, I remember when I was working this way, the expectation was that my team would be working this way. And I shifted at some point in my career at the bank where I realized I wanted to have, well, it was after this awareness of my own anxiety, and I started learning about meditation and yoga nidra and slowing down and, you know, the nervous system and how to regulate it. I started implementing a lot of these things with my own team and encouraging them to make sure that they were having balance in their lives and taking their vacation time and not calling in when they're on vacation. And taking care of themselves and making sure that priority was balanced. So that's the advice that I would give. I think we do have a responsibility, though, as managers to take care of our people. I do think since the pandemic, some places have gotten a lot better at doing that. There's more awareness around mental health than there ever was. So I think sometimes it's getting better, and then other times I don't see it.
Yeah, and you know, you pointed out so many important things there. And shout out to my boss, Brendan Ennis, who, I don't know, maybe you'll listen to this, Brendan. Although he does, I told him you were coming on. Brendan's great because I've worked with him for 4 years and he knows I love him as a leader. Right from the get-go, he was like, with other leaders there, and some choose to work on the weekends. And as an event is coming closer or there's a deadline, sometimes you have to do that. But some of the good advice I've gotten was, if you want to always reply on the weekend to emails, well, do that, because then that just opens the floodgate gate. And I was on a vacation for 4 nights, just I went down to Florida, and, you know, he needed to know something urgently from me, texted me, and I answered. And he said, you know, sorry to bug you. And then I could tell he wanted to ask something else. And I said, you know, go for it. Like, I'm okay. I can text you back. No response. He didn't want to ask. And he always tells me when I'm on vacation, if I look at an email, he's like, get off email. Like, even though we're raising money for a very important cause, we are not the oncologists there, you know, between life or death, right?
Well, I would say that, you know, we're not brain surgeons. Like, no one's going to die if I don't answer this email right away. I remember one time I was at Wonderland with my daughter on a carousel, and I was on a call. My boss was calling. And I remember saying, I'm with my daughter. Do we need to deal with this right away? And then he just kept talking. So, you know, I think I shouldn't have answered the phone, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Somebody said, like, they have their parents call while they're working, and you know, maybe they're busy at work, and then vice versa. Maybe their boss calls them when they're with family. Well, if you answer the call, you answer the call. I mean, so.
I do feel that since the pandemic, that blur between personal life and professional life, the lines have blurred quite a bit, right? Because you're working at home, so you have your home life around you, and then when you're at the office, you still are dealing with things at home. Like, it's just kind of more gray than it used to be before the pandemic.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm talking to friends about with their spouses, and if Sam's listening, I'm not saying you do this, Sam, my wife, but, you know, during the pandemic, when you were working at home, it was kind of like you had your office area, you'd go to it, you would be then working, and you'd come out for coffee or tea or lunch, but then you'd work. But now, you know, it's like I'm 3 days in the office and the other 2 days at home. There does seem to be so much of an overlap and blur now. It's like, oh, it's 10 a.m. Oh, the wash is done. I'm going to fold the laundry. Or, oh, I'm going to empty out the dishwasher. And then you just end up having to work a bit longer, which then collides into you either going to the gym or you sitting in and making dinner with your spouse, right? So I do find that interesting as people talk to me about that.
Yeah, and all the more reason to have clear boundaries and good habits for yourself established, because it would be very easy to just keep working.
So let's get into the exciting stuff. Let's pump it up a bit here. So you did so many amazing things in the banking world and in sponsorship, but what I'm truly interested in is this next evolution of your life, right? It's incredibly, it brings breath into me when I heard your story, when I started watching you on LinkedIn and being like, what are you up to? How did you find Forest Therapy? I want to start there.
Mm-hmm. Well, my partner, Andrew, and I had been talking about doing one of the pilgrimage trails in Japan, the Kimono Kodo Trail, and before the pandemic hit. We ended up not doing that, but that led to, I was watching a lot of videos about it, which led to this concept of Shinrin Yoku, which translates to forest bathing. And so Shinrin Yoku started in Japan in the 70s when they were seeing that their citizens were moving into urban areas and getting all kinds of, you know, stress-related diseases. And the government wanted to figure out, what can we do to support our citizens to live healthier lives? And they did all kinds of studies. They did find that time in the forest helped reduce their cortisol levels and their stress levels, boost their immune system. They did a lot of research and found all kinds of amazing health benefits. So in Japan, they have forest bases set up everywhere for their citizens to enjoy. And that's where the concept of forest therapy came from. So now it's kind of a global practice, and it's in Canada, we call it forest therapy. In UK, they call it forest bathing. In Australia, I think they're calling it also forest bathing. It's the same concept. We say the forest is a therapist. So I'm not a therapist, I'm a guide. And I bring people into the forest, or if we can't go into a forest, like for example, if I went into a senior's home, I would bring nature in with me and share, you know, some leaves and flowers and pine cones so that they can touch and smell and just have the sensory experience of nature. It's usually, I like to have a 3-hour walk. It can be as short as 2 hours, but any less than 2 hours, you're not getting the full benefits. So between 2 and 3 hours, we walk in the forest very, very slowly. And at first people are so uncomfortable going that slowly because we're just not used to slowing down ever. We actually spend a lot of time sitting on the forest floor and we open up all of our senses.
Do you sit with a blanket or just straight?
I bring sit pads, yeah, so like little cushions that people can borrow to use. Once in a while, someone might have knee issues or hip issues. So, you know, I invite them to bring like a little chair, like a camping chair that they can use. Or I'll find logs that are, you know, easy to get on and off of. And so it's a sensory experience. Partway through, people usually drop into liminal space. And liminal space is where you lose track of time and you kind of don't know where you are. You're just so focused on whatever it is. You might be looking at the bark of a tree or some branches, listening to the birds. You are completely in that one place, focused. And so it's like mindfulness in the forest. And at the end, we have a tea ceremony and everyone shares their experience if they want to. And we have tea, usually from plants that are foraged from the area, because we've opened up all of our senses. And at the end, we include taste as the last sense. So we taste the forest, incorporate that, and we integrate the experience by sharing. And we have a little snack. And the snack, really, part of the purpose of the snack is the chewing wakes them back up so they can safely get in their car and drive home. Like, they're that chill that we need to bring them back to their senses. It's really been a beautiful practice to share with people. It certainly helped with my healing. It's the one thing I think that really opened me up to this whole world that is right in front of our eyes that we miss, you know, this connection and even ability to communicate with nature and all the life that's around us.
Yeah, and I think it's making me think, okay, tonight it's a beautiful night out. I should go into nature. I really should, because especially in the city we live in, saying it's hard is an excuse. people don't do that as much. You know, the water's right literally not far from you here.
People walking their dogs, riding their bikes, that's not forest therapy. Forest therapy is literally spending 20 minutes with one tree and being in the energy of that tree, for example. It's very, very slow. But you can't do it on your own. You know, a guide helps you, will guide you through the experience. We have invitations that help you deepen into that connection with nature. And it's really interesting to see some of the things that come up for people. There's often a lot of tears because we don't slow down enough to even hear our own thoughts or feel our own feelings. And so some things come up that people are just holding inside and it kind of releases. And it really, you know, I was part of a retreat last week, and a women's retreat, and someone really broke down. And then at the end she said, oh, that felt good. Right? It's like, you got to get it out. First, you have to have awareness that you're holding this pain within you. Yeah. But not for everybody. Like, some people just feel joy and bliss. And, you know, I don't want people to be afraid to do it because they don't want to have these emotions. Everyone has their own experience.
And as you're walking in the forest, like when you're sitting there with a tree, you know, obviously you're not listening to anything. But if you're just when you're walking, do you suggest people don't have, say, music or a podcast in and are just listening to what's going on?
Yeah. Even one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh teaches at his monastery, we do it everywhere, is mindful walking. And feeling your footstep on the ground with each step. And even, you know, you can coordinate your steps with your breathing.
Wow. Yeah. And
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thich Nhat Hanh is someone you trained with,
Correct.
So I have never met him. Okay. He passed away before I went to his monastery.
Okay.
He's written about 300 books. And I think probably everyone's read a Thich Nhat Hanh quote or seen it on Instagram. He's quite well. He's credited for bringing mindfulness to the West. Wow. What happened was he's Vietnamese and he was exiled during the Vietnamese War because he was advocating for peace. And he ended up in France. He was exiled for 40 years. So even after the war was over, the government wouldn't let him back into Vietnam. Although he did eventually, he was able to pass away at, he lived his last few years of his life in Vietnam at his monastery. But he does teach mindful walking and a very accessible mindfulness practice.
And yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because you mentioned him a fair bit and he's quite famous and well-known. His quotes are well-known. And so you received a certification, right, or education in forest guide, being a forest guide, right? Was that Canadian based? Who'd you do it with?
The Global Institute of Forest Therapy,
wow,
which is Canadian based. And then there's one that's more global, the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy. That started in the U.S. Australia has one. England has one. So there's different associations, but their training is all based on the same standards. There's a sequence that we take people through as certified guides, and it's pretty standardized regardless of who the training is with.
Now, did you get into this, Monique, because you always enjoyed being in nature or the forest, or did you start to do that after this trip or some of these silent meditations? Like, how did you find forest therapy?
Well, it was through the Shinrin Yoku and research on this Kimono Kodo pilgrimage trail that I discovered the concept of Shinrin Yoku. And then during the pandemic, I started doing some research about forest therapy. I actually did my first forest therapy walk at my training. Ah. It was one of those things. So I think what happens when you slow down, you can hear your own intuition and your own inner voice. And I just, I say this a lot, I felt guided to it. I just knew. I have this inner knowing about things that I just knew I had to take it. And so that's how I noticed that there were trainings in Scandinavia that looked interesting. But I don't know, the Facebook ad popped up about this GIFT, Global Institute of Forest Therapy's GIFT training happening in Orangeville. And I just knew I had to do it. So that was during the pandemic.
That's so cool. That's where my wife's from, Orangeville.
Mm-hmm. It was at the Hockley Valley Ecology Retreat Center. You've probably driven by it a million times.
And her cousin works on Hockley Valley.
Yeah.
So what was the... if you don't mind speaking about it, Monique, like normally when you're an executive at a bank or you get up to be a VP level, like what did the process look like? Was it that, they wanted to bring in new leadership? You just wanted to move on in your career? You were retiring? And how did that kind of feel and transform you into this next part of your life?
Well, as you mentioned, I worked in sponsorship marketing for 15 years, and I absolutely loved that. It was my passion. And then I was tapped by my boss and up to the CEO to take over for a woman who was retiring. So they were looking for someone to take on the corporate events role. And at that point in my career, I had been given advice that if I wanted to stay on longer term, I should probably work in different departments and, broaden my experience, and was being kind of encouraged to do that. So I felt like I should do this role. And then, and it never really fit. I mean, I was brought into the role for very specific reasons. We were building CIBC Square. There's 200,000 square feet of CIBC Square was hospitality space, event space. And so
200,000
wow. square feet. So I was overseeing the corporate events spaces. So there was a dining room that's now open. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going on June the 12th, which I'm looking forward to, which is run by Oliver Bonaccini.
Yes.
There's an auditorium that seats 1,000 people. I was also responsible for the arts and artifacts. So, you know, how do we weave in the history of a 150-year-old bank into a brand new modern building? So I really enjoyed that part of the work, as well as the art collection and, you know, how do we bring our art into the space in a way that isn't, that is very contemporary and while still preserving our history and our past. So, yeah, so while I was in that role, the pandemic came along. We all moved to remote. We moved from on-site global events to virtual events. Like everyone else, you know, we were figuring out the technology. It was very, it was a very challenging time. For a while, I was on the crisis team, filling in for my boss who had to take a bit of a leave. It was a really, I mean, it was an interesting time for everyone. And then coming out of that, I, you know, this experience that I had realizing about my anxiety in 2019, at that time of the pandemic, I was already starting to implement these practices for myself, for my own healing. And so I started to change as a person. And I came to the realization that it was time for me to move on. I just felt that, you know, and I remember the conversation with my boss and I was saying, I don't know where I'm going, but I know it's time for me to go and move on. And she said, you know, you're going to go and save the world one person at a time, which was amazing.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what she said. Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah, it was lovely. She was very supportive. Although, you know, sad to see me go because we had worked together for a long, long, long time.
Wow.
And that's how it happened. And so there was a transitional period. And then I decided to retire early.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And amazing that a leader would have that positive of a reaction. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, you worked together for a long time. So she knows you. What are people going to find if they go on June 11th? I'm assuming they can, where can they buy it first of all?
First of all, it will be available on Amazon.
Okay.
And it can be ordered either the book or the digital version of the book. And over the a 2-week period, it'll be available on all booksellers' sites. It takes time to get them all up and running, but the 12th will be available on Amazon. So what they'll find is my story. And, you know, like I said, it was downloaded in a deep meditation. And I felt like as I was writing it, when I felt like giving up, because sometimes I said that in a LinkedIn post today, sometimes I just felt like, why am I doing this? I kept going because I just felt I had an obligation to share the story. There's a reason it just appeared in my mind like this. I feel like it's a story that might help people who are also struggling with anxiety and mental health. I do also talk about a depression episode that I experienced, you know, suicidal thoughts and a difficult time in my life. And the appearance of someone who's a vice president at a bank in a marriage with a child in a beautiful home and looks from the outside like she's got it all. You know, we don't know the stories that people have that they're living with inside. And so it's there's it comes with a lot of vulnerability. I'm almost going to cry sharing them. It's like, yeah, it's a vulnerable thing to share this story with the world, but I just feel like it's going to help people. I think it's also going to appeal to spiritual seekers. I talk a lot about there's some woo-woo in there. And it's also going to appeal to nomads or people who really are seeking a different way of life that it might not be the traditional way of life. You know, I ended up selling my home and everything I own. I have my car, everything I own.
What year did you do that in?
That was in, I left the bank in October 2021, and the house, we moved out on September 22. I drove my daughter to Concordia, dropped her off at residence,
yes,
and then got on a plane and headed over to the UK. Anyway, that's a whole story, the whole nomad story.
We're going to have to have you on for another second episode a year from now. We're going to have to find out how the book did. And seriously, because you know what? People probably, you know, I don't know what family you have around, how close you are with them, or obviously you probably have a huge network and friends. They must have been like, what are you doing? Like, just to not sugarcoat it. Like, you have this great job, now you're selling your house, now you're going to go digital nomad at the age you were at.
I was surprised at people's reaction. Most people were celebrating it, and so many people said, I wish I could do what you're doing, which is a big part of why I'm sharing my story, because this is, it makes me sad that people feel like, I wish I could do that, but you can.
Yes, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And you mentioned how some woo-woo, you know, I do the career coaching as well. And I always say to people, it's a little woo-woo sometimes, but I'm like, the fact you're even here and you were born into Canada is woo-woo. Like, the odds of that happening is woo-woo. The serendipity of how you got certain jobs in your life, or how you want a red car and you start seeing a red car everywhere, you know? So
the whole idea, you're so right. It is a miracle that we are even here.
That's right.
And I've come to really appreciate ancestry from the work that I did in finding my ancestor from the 1600s. But also, again, Thich Nhat Hanh, who we call Thay. It's easier to say Thay. Thay means teacher. So Thay taught a lot about honoring our ancestors. We wouldn't be here without them. But when you think about, you know, and once you start thinking about, like, if my parents had not gone on that blind date, I wouldn't be here. Yeah. And if my dad's parents didn't decide to get to, and back to the beginning of time, it is a miracle that we are here.
I'll show you something. So I was just away on vacation for 4 nights. That's my family friend, Michelle, and she's going to be embarrassed to tell this. But her grandparents and my grandparents were best friends in Burlington. My parents and her parents are best friends. And if it wasn't for her mom introducing my parents, I wouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, just to think of that, that is crazy to me. Like, right? That's crazy.
Yeah. I think we don't do enough to honor our ancestors. You know, when I was in Vietnam, I had the honor or the privilege of being invited to a family's home for Tet, and Tet is Vietnamese New Year's. And the first thing she did when we came into her home, she brought us all the way upstairs to the top floor where they had an altar with pictures of all of their family members. And she introduced me to her grandparents and told the stories of her ancestors. And this is what they do New Year's Eve. They had lit some incense, and they had food on the altar, and they said, we don't prepare our food until the incense is all burned. And we sat there on the sofa, and she told us the story of our ancestors. It was like they were in the room with us. And I thought that was so beautiful.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, I'm going to encourage everyone to go out and find this book, Intentionally Lost.
Lost Intentionally.
By the way, who did the graphics?
My publisher.
Incredible.
Soulseed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was incredible. I could spend an hour just talking about the process of bringing a book to life, but it was 9 rounds of creative to get to this. I'm thrilled with it, and they did a great job.
So Lost Intentionally. How else can people find you? I know you're active on LinkedIn.
I'm on LinkedIn and Instagram. Flourish with Manek is, my brand. And so flourishwithmanek.com, everything's on there, or on Instagram, flourishwithmanek, or just my name on LinkedIn. So do feel free to reach out. I really do. I love connecting with people. I love hearing people's stories.
Well, and I think what you said before we even hit record that really resonated with me. I spoke with you, Manek, about early in my career coming up to you at, shout out to Sponsorship Marketing Council of Canada. Yes. You know, you mentioned how much they did for your career, and you held incredible positions with them and received the Hall of Fame honor from them. It's been, meaningful and has built a network in my career. But coming up to you and you saying, and me saying, oh, well, you're a VP at CIBC. And I was just, a young nobody at the time, but it took me a long time to realize, no, I was somebody. I was somebody, and I was going to become someone. And you said, it's not about people's titles, and it's really not. It's about who they are as a human. And so I just want to say to you, I'm very grateful that you put your trust in me to tell your story. I'm very grateful to have be in the same room with you. So thank you for taking the time. And I always end these off with three quick, I call them zigzag questions, because it's not a straight line. And from a professor to the bank to forest guide and what you're doing now and how lost intentionally, it's quite the story. So let's end it off. And I always kind of change these up a bit based on the guests. So a quick phrase or a one word, whatever you want to go with. You've traveled a lot. Where's an interesting place you've been to that you think's pretty underrated in people's minds and they should probably take another look at?
Underrated.
Where you're like, you should go there and you probably haven't thought about it.
Mm. Oh my goodness, there's so many places. I quite liked the Galician region in Spain, and I stayed at a nomad house called Islo in Laxe, L-A-X-E, L-A-X-E, Laxe, Spain. So Islo nomad house is a very cool place to be. Especially if you like surfing.
We're going to put that in the show notes. some people from the sponsorship industry are probably going to watch this. What was one of the favorite sponsorship deals? And maybe you don't have a favorite, but what's one that stuck out during your career or the story of it?
Yeah, these are hard questions.
I know. I should have provided these before.
Because I've just really loved all of the partnerships. Mm-hmm. I think probably the TO 2015 Pan Am Games was a highlight, because we were able to do so much.
You were.
With the community, with the athletes, you know, our Team Next. I still keep in touch with the athletes that we sponsored on CIBC Team Next.
Wow.
Really, you know, because I'm so relationship focused, it was, I actually talk about going to the Paralympics in Sochi in my book and the influence that the Paralympians had on my life.
There's a mentor of mine, Kevin Rempel, who's been on twice, and Kevin won the bronze in para ice hockey in 2014 in Sochi. So that's incredible that they had such an impact. And you were on the board, were you not, at the Paralympics at one point? Or did I see that you were?
Yeah, the Canadian Paralympic Committee, yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, with Francois Robert and the great team there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the final question, let's wrap it up. You spoke about how, you know, we can be more intentional about setting boundaries at work and in moments with our families. What is the piece of advice you give to your 19-year-old daughter when she's looking at her career now?
Well, it's funny because she asked me about LinkedIn about a month ago. And so we got her set up there, and I said, do you want me to reach out to my network? And she said, oh, that'd be great. She's never had an interest in networking before, so this is kind of a big deal. She's starting to think about her career. And I did a post about, please welcome my daughter to LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And
I saw it. I remember seeing this. Yeah.
The response to that has been amazing. There was one person that sent her a note. I didn't even know this was happening. She told me after. From someone who sent her a note to say, your mom helped my daughter when she was your age. So if there's anyone in your network you'd like me to introduce you to, let me know. Yeah. And so my advice to her was just ask. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to ask. And at any level, you know, your comment about me being a VP, title doesn't matter. People just want to help each other. And so if you are curious about somebody, or if you think they can help you, there's no harm in just ask the question. They might say no, but they might say yes. Mm-hmm. They'll probably say yes. In my experience, you know, if people approached me, I was happy to try to help them out if I could.
I think it's that old saying of a lot of people say, like, what if this happens? Or what if this doesn't happen? It's like, well, what if it does? Mm-hmm. What if it does?
Yeah.
What if that does work out, that person you reached out to that you didn't think would respond to you? Mm-hmm. So, Minik, thanks so much for hanging out on It's Not a Straight Line.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you. What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line, or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it.
You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.